And the time is 5:30. That means it's time for another broadcast of Sufism, the Heart of Islam. I'm your host, Wendy McLaughlin. And tonight with me in the studio is Sheikh Ibrahim Gamard. He's a sheikh in the Mevlevi Sufi order and the author of many books on the work of Jalaluddin Rumi. I hope you can stay tuned. This is Sufism, the Heart of Islam. Welcome to Sufism, the Heart of Islam. I'm your host, Wendy McLaughlin, and with me in the studio tonight is Sheikh Ibrahim Gamard, a sheikh in the Mevlevi order. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh.
Wa alaikum assalam.
Nice to have you here. Ibrahim Gamard was born and raised in the United States, and he's a licensed psychologist. He's been a student of Sufism for over 35 years. He converted to Islam in 1984 and went on the pilgrimage to Mecca in 1999. He's been affiliated with the Mevlevi tradition of Islamic Sufism since 1976. In 2007, he was made a Mevlevi Sheikh, or authorized teacher, by Farouk Hamdan Chelebi, the 22nd generation direct descendant of Mevlana Jalaluddin Rumi and the international leader of the Mevlevi tradition. Well, welcome.
Thank you.
I'd like to start by asking you to tell us a little bit about the Mevlevi tradition, since you are made a sheikh by the 22nd direct descendant of Jalaluddin Rumi. Tell us a little bit about the history of that order of Sufi.
Well, of course, it begins with Mevlana Jalaluddin Rumi, who was born in 1207 and died in 1273. And he came out of a very normative tradition of Islamic mysticism. His father was a remarkable Sufi, a remarkable mystic, who worked as a preacher. And his father decided to move the family to the west ahead of the Mongol invasion in the Balkh area of what is now northwestern Afghanistan. And that city, a very ancient city of Balkh, was destroyed a few years after the family left. They passed through Mecca and they came to Anatolia, which is now in Turkey, and which was a safe region. Eventually the Mongols came, but they surrounded the town of Konya, where Mevlana Rumi lived, but they just tore down the walls. They did not destroy the city. I think they were afraid of, they had heard there was a great saint there, who was Mevlana Rumi, and so they just tore the walls down. But that part of Anatolia was safe, and a lot of highly educated Persian-speaking, Arabic-speaking scholars came from eastern Persia to a safe area where they were welcomed and hired and valued for their scholarship, as was Mevlana Rumi's father.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that Jalaluddin Rumi was born in what is now Afghanistan, in a town called Balkh.
Yes.
Have you been back to that town? Does it still exist?
Yes, I have. I have. It was it used to be called the Mother of Cities. It was so ancient. But every living thing was killed by the Mongols. And I was there in 2007, which was the celebration of the 800th birthday of Mevlana Rumi. There was a conference in Kabul, and then we Rumi scholars were flown to Mazar-e-Sharif, and then we took a short trip to Balkh. And we could see the hills around Balkh and some old mosques. There was one mosque where Mevlana Rumi was said to have been brought as a little boy by his father. It was a Sufi mosque. And I imagined the Mongols charging over those hills. And
is he still? Sorry, go ahead.
Then after I was in Balkh, 2 days later, I was in Konya. Mm. So I made the trip in 2 days that they spent years. Maulana Rumi's father spent, family spent years with that trip.
Is Mevlana still celebrated in this tiny town of, or maybe it's not a tiny town, I don't know, in the town of Balkh?
There is a Maulana center there.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
I've seen pictures of the building, but I didn't go there. But, mm-hmm. but there is a wealthy Iranian built a Mevlana Rumi center there, and there's a sister center in New York City.
Oh. Do you know, are there any currently practicing Sufis in Balkh, this Mevlevi Sufis?
I don't know.
You don't know? Yeah. No. You didn't meet any there on your trip?
Not in Balkh, because it was a quick trip.
Yeah, yeah. So continue with the history. Mevlana's family made it to Konya, Turkey.
So they moved to one town in Anatolia where Maulana's Rumi, his mother and his brother died. He got married in that town. And then eventually Konya, which was the capital of the Seljuk rulers, the Seljuk Turkish rulers, who valued Persian-speaking scholars, because Persian was the learned language of the Seljuks, Seljuk Turks, amazingly enough. So they invited Maulana Rumi's father to move to Konya, which was the ancient Iconium mentioned in the Bible.
Oh.
But now it's called Konya. And his father was invited to move there and teach.
So his father was a Quranic scholar, a traditional Islamic scholar, is that right?
As well as a remarkable mystic.
Oh.
Yes. He wrote a diary of his mystical experiences.
Oh.
Which has not been translated into English as yet.
Will you do that for us?
I think Professor Franklin Lewis may be doing
that. I'd like to read that.
Yes.
Have you read it in Persian?
I have it in my library, but it's difficult. Yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's archaic Persian?
Yes.
I see.
So anyway, Maulana Rumi's father died, and then after his father died, his father's chief successor, whose name was Sayyid Burhanuddin Tirmidhi, came and he taught Maulana for 9 years. So he was his first Sufi teacher and arranged for him to go to Syria to get a traditional Islamic education in the Arabic language and put him through some 40-day retreats and pronounced him completed in the Islamic sciences and the mystical sciences.
At what age was he pronounced completed?
I'd have to look that up.
Okay. Was he under 30?
But he was in his mid-30s.
Yeah, okay.
So then after 9 years, the Sayyid died. And meanwhile, Maulana had already been the successor to his father and was teaching at local colleges and had some Sufi students, because his father was a Sufi master. Mm. And when his father's foremost Sufi disciple, the Sayyid, died, then Maulana Rumi went to visit his grave. And not long after that, Shamsi Tabrizi arrived.
Mm.
And then for a three-year period, it was a period of complete turmoil for Maulana Rumi with his second Sufi teacher, Shamsi Tabriz, whose impact was completely transformative. And at a certain point when Shams left, he actually, I believe, was cooking Maulana Rumi by his absences.
Mm-hmm.
When he took off and disappeared to Syria because of the jealousy of his of Rumi's disciples, Rumi's passion erupted, his mystical passion erupted, and he began to compose ecstatic poetry. He stopped reading books. He stopped teaching. He stopped preaching. He immersed himself in mystical music, mystical poetry, mystical movements that are mistakenly called dance, but they're dance-like at times.
Mm-hmm.
But these are spiritual movements inspired by mystical poetry, mystical music, and he immersed himself in mystical states of consciousness for great lengths of period of time, of all kind, a full range of experiences, so that he was transformed to another level. Although he began as a mature Sufi, after the 9-year training,
right,
it took him even further.
If he was taken over or allowed himself to be taken over by these mystical states, I imagine, to the extent that you're talking about, I imagine that his everyday life must have sort of fallen apart. Is that the case?
Yes. Well, he had appointed some other people to train the dervishes. And, of course, he was a very inspiring speaker, and they missed hearing him speak because he was a wonderful had extraordinary, inspiring abilities. But he just immersed himself in states and mystical longing for his teacher and longing for God, and it transformed him from the state of fana, or annihilation in the master, to a state of annihilation in God alone after the second disappearance of Shamsi Tabrizi. Now, according to some sources, he was murdered, but there's Professor Franklin Lewis's critiqued that and concluded there's no evidence of that. And actually, writings. Shamsi Tabrizi wrote, his disciples wrote down his speeches. So we have recently, in the last 10 years in English, excerpts of Shamsi Tabrizi's words as recorded by his disciples. And what he says is that he needed to leave Maulana Rumi so that he would mature and reach a stage where he could complete the work that he needed to do. So he's basically saying he needed to get out of the way.
Why do you think these stories of him being murdered have been perpetuated?
Because there's his biographer or hagiographer. A hagiography is a saint's biography enhanced with miracle stories to make the saint more saintly. He's collected all of the stories about Maulana Rumi, and including was a story that Shamsi Tabrizi had been murdered and then just the body just disappeared into thin air. So it's one of these miracle stories.
I see.
And Professor Lewis concluded that that Rumi's disciples could not have hidden the fact that his teacher was murdered. In fact, he spent several years traveling to Syria, made two or three trips to Syria looking for his teacher. If he believed that he was murdered, I mean, how could they have kept that from him? He went looking for him until he finally, as his son, as Maulana Rumi's son, recorded in his poetry, that his father found Shams within his own heart.
So Rumi's father was a mystic. Rumi was obviously a mystic and a poet.
And his son was a remarkable mystical poet as well.
Yeah. If you've just joined us, you're tuned to Sufism, the Heart of Islam, here on KWMR. I'm your host, Wendy McLaughlin. With me in the studio is Sheikh Ibrahim Gamard. He's a sheikh in the Mevlevi order, and he's also the author of many books on Mevlana Jalaluddin Rumi. So you mentioned that although Rumi was born in Afghanistan, his family early in his life migrated to Turkey, where I'm assuming the Mevlevi order began and grew from.
That's correct.
Birthplace of Mevlevi order. So how did it... Now, you know, you're born and raised in America. You're Mevlevi. There's lots of Mevlevis. The most popular image of Sufis, as you and I both know, is of the dervishes, the people turning in the long white skirts and the conical hats. How did it get from Turkey around the world?
Well, for most of the history of the Mevlevi Sufi order, which is the order that has preserved the teachings of Maulana Rumi, for most of the centuries of its existence, it never spread beyond the Ottoman Empire. Now, the Ottoman Empire was huge and included Arabia, Egypt, Albania, Yugoslavia. So there were Mevlevi centers, Sufi centers, in all of those countries that were part of the Ottoman Empire, but it never really spread past that. Now, in recent times, it has spread to the West, to Europe and America, And that's been a new chapter for the Mevlevi tradition. But part of the reason for that is that it has been suppressed. In 1925, all Sufi orders, Sufi organizations in Turkey were made illegal, were shut down. Their titles, names, dervish professions were all made illegal. And as a result, the Mevlevi tradition is actually not widespread. It is actually very weakened after all these years of being illegal.
Oh.
There are only a few Mevlevi teachers in Turkey left. Most of them are in their 70s.
It's still illegal in Turkey?
Still, all.
Why?
Organized Sufism.
Because
We go back to the end of World War I when the Young Turks had a revolution and overthrew the Ottoman Empire. And Kemalettin Atatürk was the leader of a secularist movement, and they decided that many aspects of Turkish culture were keeping Turkey backwards, and it included Islam and Sufism and the Ottoman Turkish language, which had enormous amounts of Arabic and Persian words, and so they purified the Turkish language of a lot of the original vocabulary. They commanded that the call to prayer be made in Turkish from the mosques. Mm. They were very restrictive. They just believed that they wanted to modernize Turkey and felt that the Sufi orders and centers were holding the country back from stepping into the basically keeping up with Western Europe and modernizing.
Right. So let's move to the turning. Let's jump to the turning, which you, a few minutes ago, I think you mentioned that it's not a dance, it's a meditation. Can you talk a little bit about the derivation of the turn? Do you yourself turn?
Yes.
Uh-huh. So can you talk about the derivation of it, what's actually happening? You know, I've been to a couple of semas where people turn in public in front of audiences, and I've never really understood why they turn in front of people as if it's a performance. So maybe you can explain.
Well, that is a degeneration of the world, the Sufi whirling and Mevlevi tradition. You have to go back to the 9th century. That's Common Era, after the 3rd century in Islam, in Baghdad, when Islam was very successful and became very outward and materialistic, and Sufism grew strong in that era, in Baghdad especially, and they developed something called sama, which literally means audition, which means listening to mystical music or mystical instruments being played in a mystical way, and mystical poetry, mystical verses. And it inspired the dervishes to move in a way of surrendering only to not moving by the mind or the will, the personal will, but moving by being inspired. So sometimes there were dance-like movements, and sometimes there was whirling. But it was to surrender to the will of Allah was the purpose of it. And I believe that whirling in Islam among Sufis is inspired by the verse in the Quran, whichever way you turn, there is the face of God. Mm-hmm. So a lot of Sufi practices that were developed in Baghdad at this time were mystical interpretations of the Quran. Mm-hmm. So this kind of what I call audition is the word for it, moving spontaneously in a mystical state of consciousness, was practiced by Sufis for several centuries before Maulana Rumi's time.
Oh,
so in his time he did it in Shamsi Tabrizi did sema in the way that it had been done for centuries. It was completely spontaneous.
Mm.
There might have been shouting of the names of God,
or
of the name of God. There was, hand flapping. There was
hand flapping.
which is kind of a dance-like, as described. Oh. They might have sat down, they might have prostrated, they might have...
Oh, so it was much more jazz-like than what we see now. Which
yeah,
is
it
very...
was completely individual, a personal surrender, you know, in a group of men.
And it's very different.
And it was not a performance by any stretch of the imagination. Now, Rumi loved to whirl, and a lot of his poetry is said to have been composed while he was whirling.
Mm. Did he speak it out and someone wrote it down? Is that how?
Yes, yes. And I believe that his feet were probably moving to the different poetic meters as well as he composed. That's, of course, speculation. But but eventually the whirling was turned into a kind of choreography among the Mevlevi Sufis centuries later, many centuries later, into the 1600s. It was formalized as we see it today, more or less. And it it is a form of remembrance of God, because if the whirling dervish focuses on the heart, and if you lose the focus on the heart, you lose your balance. So it's a way of focusing on the name of Allah alone within the Kaaba, shall we say, of the heart. And it's very mystical. And of course, whichever way you turn, there's the face of Allah. And there's a lot of Islamic symbolism in it. So as a form of zikr or remembrance of God, it can be justified as a way of enhancing the concentration of the dervish on God alone. Now, after the Sufi orders were made illegal, in about 1951, the government allowed performances to be done for tourists in Konya on the solar anniversary of Rumi's death, which is December 17th. So as a result, every year on December 17th, these performances developed, were done in Konya in December, and it became more and more a theater production.
I see.
And so the justification as a form of Islamic zikr or remembrance became very weakened. And maybe I think it can only be even mildly justified if even a few of the dervishes are trying to say silently the name of Allah, Allah, Allah with each circulation. Then it only has that tiny justification, because it's turned into a theater performance, very unfortunately.
You mentioned that Sufism has since 1922, I think you said, been illegal in Turkey. And yet this was the birthplace of your order, the Mevlevi order. Where is it strongest now? Is it the United States, Western Europe, or is it slowly reviving in Turkey or the Ottoman Empire, let's call it?
Well, it's been strongest in Istanbul for many, many years. In Konya, is the main focus has been there's a government organization where professional whirlers are paid by the government to whirl, and they travel as a troupe with musicians to cities in Turkey and Europe and sometimes the United States, and they're professional whirlers. And some of them are whirling just as a profession. Some of them are Sufis, but quite a number of them belong to other Sufi orders. Some of them are Mevlevis. It's really watered down considerably in Konya. But there is Mevlevi activity still in Konya. And I've been to Konya many times, and I have friends there that I can meet with and do the Muslim prayers together with, and Mevlevi zikr.
So if you, for example, are not interested in doing the sama or doing the whirling publicly, does one do it alone at home, or do you need to have a group of other people to practice with?
One can do it alone at home.
Yes. You do it?
But it should be done privately, and it should be done correctly. It should be done within especially constructed whirling prayer ceremony room, as it was for centuries, in those whirling halls, where they were built just for the this ceremony all over the Ottoman Empire.
But if you don't have a whirling room in your house, can you just, I mean, does one, if, you know, if that's one of your practices, don't
yes,
you just do
yes,
it at home?
Yes, you can, if it's, especially if it's assigned by your Sufi teacher.
Right, right.
I began whirling in 1975, was initiated in 1976 by a Mevlevi sheikh, or authorized teacher, that came from Konya. He was in his 70s in Los Angeles. And then in 1977, I went with my wife to Konya, went to Rumi's tomb for the first time, a place of what I call the perfume of love.
Tell us about that. Tell us about your experience at Rumi's tomb.
It was just, it changed my life literally, because to go to a place where there's such a holy presence immediately in front of you, emanating such perfume of love, is just an extraordinary experience, that there could be a place that would have such a place of a feeling of holiness and blessing. And then I've been to his tomb many times. I went 10 times in 5 years, from 2003 to 2008.
That sounds like an addiction.
2007 or 8. I went twice a year.
Mm-hmm.
And the last time I went was a year and a half ago. I spent 20 days in Konya during Ramadan, during the fasting month.
Wow.
And went to Shamsi Tabrizi's memorial mosque every morning for prayers. And then I went to Mevlana's tomb twice a day, and spent long periods of time there doing zikr, or remembrance of Allah, in front of his tomb. And then went to the main mosque next to the Mevlana Rumi Center for the Ramadan Taraweeh prayers, special prayers.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, and then I would get together with a Mevlevi sheikh friend of mine that is a leader of a whirling prayer group in Konya. And also I whirled in America many times, and also about six or seven times in Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
I whirled with the whirling dervish groups that were led by friends of mine that were the sheikhs or leaders.
That sounds like an incredible Ramadan, an incredible time that you had.
Yes, and that, during that time, my new turban, my new Mevlevi turban, was placed under the covering of Maulana Rumi's tomb, which is the tradition for a new sheikh to have his turban blessed by proximity or closeness to Maulana Rumi's tomb. It was
the next best thing to having him put it on your head.
An extraordinary blessing.
Wow.
Thanks be to God.
Mashallah.
Praise be to God. Alhamdulillah.
Alhamdulillah. Well, Sheikh Ibrahim, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to talk about Rumi's poetry. You've written some books on his poetry. We're going to talk about translations and versions and all things Rumi. So we're going to take a short break. If you've just joined us, you're tuned to Sufism, the Heart of Islam, here on KWMR. We need to take a short break, and before we do, I wanted to let you know that the West Marin Report, KWMR's local news program, is produced with the help of volunteer reporters from throughout West Marin. It airs Monday through Friday at 6:30 a.m., 8 a.m., 6:30 p.m., and 11:50 p.m. You can hear it Saturday and Sunday at 8:50 a.m. You can listen to the West Marin Report also online anytime at kwmr.org/news, and you can sign up to get the podcast. We're going to take a short break, play a little music. When we come back, I'll be speaking more with Sheikh Ibrahim Gamard about the poetry and work of Jalaluddin Rumi. Please stay tuned. This is Sufism, the Heart of Islam. I put it down because it was in my way. Is that it?
Yeah.
Sure. Exorcised.
Yeah. At my door. I said, your humble servant. He said, what business do you have? I said, to greet you, O Lord. He said, how long will you journey on? I said, until you stop me. He said, how long will you boil in the fire? I said, until I am pure. This is my oath of love. For the sake of love, I gave up wealth and position. He said, you have pleaded your case, but you have no witness. I said, my tears are my witness. The pallor of my face is my proof. Said your witness has no credibility. Your eyes are too wet to see. I said, by the splendor of your justice, my eyes are clear and faultless. He said, what do you seek? I said, to have you as my constant friend. He said, what do you want from me? I said, your abundant grace. He said, who was your companion on the journey? I said, the thought of you, O King. He said, what called you here? I said, the fragrance of your wine. What brings you the most fulfillment? I said, the company of the emperor. He said, what do you find there? I said, 100 miracles. He said, why is the palace deserted? I said, they all fear the thief. He said, who is the thief? I said, the one who keeps me from you. He said, where is their safety? I said, in service and renunciation. He said, what is there to renounce? I said, the hope of salvation. He said, where is their calamity? I said, in the presence of your love. He said, how do you benefit from this life? I said, by keeping true to myself. Now it is time for silence. If I told you about his true essence, you would fly from yourself and be gone. And neither door nor roof could hold you back.
Welcome back to Sufism, the Heart of Islam. I'm your host, Wendy McLaughlin, and with me in the studio tonight is Sheikh Ibrahim Gamard. He's a Mevlevi Sufi sheikh and an author and translator of a lot of Mevlana Jalaluddin Rumi's work. And we're going to talk about that now, Sheikh Ibrahim. Let's just talk briefly about that song that just played at the halftime. That was one of Mevlana's poems.
Yes, it's a ghazal. Or a lyric poem. He composed over 3,000 of these poems based on generally 23 different poetic meters. Many of them end with an appeal to silence, where he says words cannot express the truth of what I'm trying to convey. Other poems end with references to his second Sufi teacher, Shamsi Tabrizi, mentioning the city of Tabriz, or the sun, and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that many of the poems end with an appeal to silence. Doesn't the Masnavi begin with an appeal to listen?
That's correct, yes.
He's very...
Listen to this reed flute. Yeah.
So you've got some papers in front of you. Would you like to start with what you've got there?
Oh, I have... I'm prepared for... quite a number of issues and questions, but since you mentioned the Masnavi,
yes,
which means rhymed couplets, and this was the masterpiece of his later years that he composed, and full of Sufi wisdom stories, and
it's often referred to as the Persian Quran.
Yes, that's because it expresses so much of the Quran, so many stories of the prophets and the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, that, and he had clearly memorized the Quran, and there are just hundreds and hundreds of references to the Quran in the Masnavi. Now, I'd like to just explain the symbolism of the reed flute in our Mevlevi tradition.
Yeah.
It symbolizes the soul and its yearning to return to the home of the soul. So the reed flute is cut, and it mourns its separation. And it says that it was cut and made into a reed flute with holes placed in it. And many people think that the music is about a wedding or about a celebration or about this or that, but the real melody, or the real message of the reed flute is yearning to return to the soul's home.
Mm-hmm.
So the beginning of the Masnavi or Mathnawi begins, listen to the reed flute, how it is complaining. It is telling about separations, saying, ever since I was severed from the reed field, men and women have lamented in the presence of my shrill cries, but I want a heart which is torn from separation, so that I may explain the pain of yearning. Anyone who remained far from his roots seeks a return to the time of his union. I lamented in every gathering I associated with those in bad or happy circumstances, but everyone became my friend from his own opinion. He did not seek my secrets from within me. So then in Persian, it's a rhyming couplet. Bishnoin ne chun chikoyat mikonad, as judai ha hekoyat mekonad. Bishnoin ne chun chikoyat mekonad, as judai ha hekoyat mekonad. Kazne istan ta merobu brida and dar nafira merdozana lida and sina khoham sharha sharha az farag ta beguyam sharha darde ishtiyag. هر کسی کو دور ماند از اصل خیش باز جوید روزگار وصل خیش. So that's my own Masnavi melody that I use to go deeper into the poetry.
Do you often do you sing the poetry as a practice?
I sing it silently as I read the Masnavi.
Mm. And the translation that you read, is that your translation?
That is my translation.
Tell us a little bit about how you go about doing the translation. I know you read Persian, so you can read the original. And then how do you do it?
Well, I was so in love with the Masnavi that I decided in about 1980, 81 to teach myself Persian so I could read it in the original. And I just began with an accurate translation, and I learned to look up words in a Persian dictionary. The alphabet is differently arranged. And when I did that, I began with this very first line that I just recited. Mm. Beshnao, listen, comes from the verb shenidan, to this, nay, that is complaining. And I looked up all the words in the dictionary, you know. Until the words became my friends, and then I fell in love with the images, the nightingale's love of the rose, and the so many different images of yearning love, and I fell in love with those images. And eventually I started a website called daralmasnavi.org.
Which I highly recommend to anyone out there listening. Can you say that again? Daralmasnavi.org.
daralmasnavi.org.
A wonderful website.
And I put all of my Masnavi translations and ghazal or lyric poetry translations and many other articles on the website. And anyone that wants to email me with responses to this interview or have any questions relating to Maulana Rumi, please email me, care of the Daral Masnavi website.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Sufism, the Heart of Islam, here on KWMR. I'm your host, Wendy McLaughlin. With me in the studio is Sheikh Ibrahim Gamard. He's a sheikh in the Mevlevi order and a translator of Jalaluddin Rumi's work. So you taught yourself Persian by reading the dictionary and by falling in love. That's gave you the himma or the desire to...
And I had a very accurate
translation. Okay, so let's talk about that because, as you and I both know, Rumi is often touted as the most popular poet in the United States. So there's been a huge popularization of Rumi.
Yes.
Can you talk about that? About a month ago, Bob Dar was on the show, and
yes.
I talked about it with him, and because both David Fidler and Coleman Barks have also been on the show, very different approaches to translating Jalaluddin's work.
Yes.
Where do you fall in this whole translation of Rumi's work and the popularization of Rumi's work?
Well, I was so unhappy with the distortions of the popular versions that when I translated Maulana Rumi's Quatrains, which I worked on for 22 years with an Afghan scholar named Rawan Farhadi, and it's published as The Quatrains of Rumi, came out in 2008, and our translation is very literal. We we put words that are not any words, extra words, explanatory words are put in italics. So the reader knows which are the words translated from the original Persian and which are added, you know, for the flow of the translation.
Mm-hmm.
But it was in large part in reaction to the popularized versions. Now, I explain on my website that translations are done by people that know Persian, that can read Persian. But many of the popular books have renditions that are claimed as translations or translated by so-and-so, but they're actually, the author does not know Persian. So this misleads the public in this way and gives a distorted view of what Maulana taught or what he wrote about in his poetry. But I take a kindly view of this because I'm actually grateful that Rumi has been popularized because his name has such a positive response. So many people have heard of Rumi, associate his name with mysticism and joy and ecstatic poetry mm-hmm. and divine love, that I'm grateful for despite all the distortions, because what I'm interested in my books and my website is reaching the people that are most serious about wanting to know what Maulana Rumi actually taught.
Mm-hmm.
So the more his poetry is popularized, the more serious seekers get develop the desire or the motivation to find out more about his teachings in poetry at a deeper, more accurate level.
Right.
So I make a distinction between versions and translations, and I say that the people that don't know Persian, their work should be called versions.
Mm-hmm.
They could be called versionizers or explanatory makers of renditions that mm-hmm, are mm-hmm. interpretive, poetic
right.
interpretive
right.
versions. And that way it's clearer as to what's going on. I'd like to give an example of...
Oh, yeah, I was going to mention book. That your
there's
website
a,
has wonderful examples.
There's
a famous...
Version that is considered one of the most well-known quatrains of Rumi
mm-hmm.
That has the famous line, there are a hundred ways to kneel and kiss the ground, let the beauty we love be what we do.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a version by Coleman Barks.
Mm-hmm.
And I will read an accurate translation from our book, The Quatrains of Rumi. Today, like every day, we are ruined by wine. Wine is in parentheses. It's understood that it's ruined by mystical state of intoxication,
mm-hmm.
of which wine is the symbol.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Coleman Barks interpreted that as, today, like every other day, we wake up empty and frightened.
Hmm.
Now, the next line, don't open the door of worry and take up the vial instead. The vial is like a Chinese violin played in the lap called the rubab. Don't open the door of worry or thought or thinking and take up the vial instead. Now, Mr. Barks interpreted that line, don't open the door to the study and begin reading. Take down the dulcimer, later changed to take down a musical instrument. Now, in the next line in the original Persian is, there are 100 kinds of prayer, bowing, and prostration, using the Islamic terms for namaz, bowing is ruku, and sajda is the prostration.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he rendered that as, there are hundreds of ways to kneel and kiss the ground. That's so different.
Mm-hmm.
It's very New Agey.
Mm-hmm.
Then the last line, there are 100 kinds of prayer, bowing, and prostration for the one whose prayer niche, which is the prayer direction in Islam, for the one whose prayer niche is the beauty of the beloved. It's such a beautiful line. Now, mm-hmm. he rendered that, let the beauty we love be what we do.
Mm-hmm.
It's 95% his own originality. He's mm-hmm. a very gifted poet. And
yeah.
It seems that he... he couldn't resist, you know, being creative. But it's a very beautiful line in and of itself. It just is not Rumi's line at all. It's something else. And I say that the accurate translation is so much more beautiful than the version, because it shows that Sufism is the heart of Islam, that the Sufis were not just praying five times a day. They were praying and remembering Allah in hundreds of ways, because he said there are 100 kinds of prayer, bowing in prostration, doing different chores, doing different daily acts of daily life, praying, doing zikr, remembering Allah all the time. And for the one whose prayer direction is the beauty of the divine beloved. It's, so the original is so much more beautiful than the interpretation.
Yeah, well, it is to you and me. I wonder how it is to somebody who's not a Muslim. But when I was reading your, you have many examples like this on your website.
Yes.
So I recommend, if the listener's interested, to take a look at Sheikh Ibrahim's website. The translations that you gave in contrast to the popular translations were so much deeper for me. So I can only speak for myself, but
let me read this in Persian to show you the melody that I use for this.
And does this rhyme? Is this written in rhyming couplets as well?
No, the quatrain, usually the first, second, and fourth lines rhyme. And
okay.
The third allows the poet some freedom.
Right. I remember that.
So this is the same poem that we're discussing. There are 100 kinds of prayer, bowing, and prostration for the one whose prayer niche is the beauty of the beloved. And this is the melody I use for quatrains in Persian. Imruz chuharuz kharabim kharab magshadare andishe obergir rubab sad guna namaz asto ruku asto sujood on ra ke jamale dus bashad mihrab. So that's the quatrain melody that I use to go deeper into the quatrains.
And is this the Masnavi as well?
No, this is from his collected poetic works called the Divan-e Shamsi Tabrizi.
Right.
There are over 3,000 ghazals, and there are about 1,600 quatrains and some other kinds of poetry. And this is a different poetic work than the Mathnawi.
And these quatrains were written out of love of Shams? It was after Shams had left for the last time?
They were written in many different circumstances. Mm-hmm. He was composing ghazals or lyric poems and quatrains constantly.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, he spent most of his time working on the Masnavi in his last 15 years.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned on your website, or there's a button or a line in your website called Guidance from the Masnavi. Can you give us some of the guidance that comes from the Masnavi? What does one learn, or give us a morsel from the Masnavi?
There's so much. It's hard, hard to answer that question. But it's a path of love, love of God, or love of all creation, and there's so much compassion and descriptions of mystical states that he. Are described as the experiences of various characters in the story that are most probably Maulana Rumi's own mystical states of consciousness, and the it's just so sublime. I can't answer.
Okay. How about a little earthier question? People are very interested in the relationship between Shams and Mevlana Jalaluddin Rumi, and I did read on your website. A very interesting explanation of that. Could you go briefly into that?
Yes. First of all, it's important to understand the relationship between the Sufi disciple and the Sufi master, and the particular type of Sufism is based on the lover beloved relationship, which is what was happening in the case of Maulana Rumi and his teacher, and is expressed as in so many of the quatrains. In fact, we've arranged the quatrains according to different levels and stages that we've come up with in the book, the quatrains of Rumi, that show that illustrate the different stages of the lover and beloved. And it's important to understand that there's something in Sufism called the annihilation of the disciple in the master. It's called fana fi sheikh, and annihilation in the presence, the mystical presence of the master. The disciple experiences himself as annihilated or nothing, and that is a stage that leads to annihilation in Allah only, fana fillah. And I think that this is the best way to understand the relationship between Maulana Rumi and his teacher Shamsi Tabrizi, that in the divan, or when he was composing so many of these poems, the 3,000 poems, the ghazals, he was seeing his teacher in everything, in every flower, in every tree, in the stars, the sun, every image, thousands of images in his poetry. He was in this state of mystical intoxication, absorbed in his master, and that's why he ends so many of the poems with his master's name, mm-hmm. instead of his own name, as was traditional. And because he was in that state of disappearance or passing away or annihilation in the master, where all he could see was his master everywhere. Mm-hmm. And then that was the lyrical poems that he composed. And then towards the end of his life, he was in the state of passing away in Allah. And so then he wrote very few references to Shamsi Tabriz in his Masnavi, which was six books of 3,000 couplets each, you know, an enormous work, very little mention of Shamsi Tabrizi. Mm. By that stage, he was in...
Oh, I see.
Passing away in Allah.
I see.
And that is important to understand the distinction between these two stages of his life.
Oh, that's very interesting. Mm. Well, we only have about another half minute or so left, Sheikh Ibrahim. So would you like to give the listeners any more information about where to find your books or how to get a hold of you?
Yes, you can buy the Quatrains of Rumi through Amazon.com. Just do a search for Quatrains, Rumi. You'll find it. My first book, Rumi in Islam, was originally titled Rumi on Muhammad. It tells stories from the Masnavi about the Prophet's virtues and the way that Maulana Rumi praises the Prophet Muhammad. Mm-hmm. And that book came out in 2004. It's called Rumi and Islam.
And that's also available on Amazon.
Yes, mm-hmm. And you can please write me through my website, daralmasnavi.org.
Well, I want to thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure to talk with you, Sheikh Ibrahim, and I wish you the best with your work.
Thank you very much.
Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam.
And that's all for tonight's show. I want to thank my guest, Sheikh Ibrahim Gamard, and thank all of you for listening. Now, please stay tuned for the West Marin Report at 6:30, and then Shorty's Bunkhouse starts promptly at 6:40. I'll be back in 2 weeks, inshallah. Until then, salam alaikum.